The estimates on the numbers of homeless people are rough, but by most counts, somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Americans do not have permanent homes. We continue to look for ways to get services to homeless people and perhaps even get them into homes, but it's not quick work, and our guest this hour knows that. Josephine Ensign works to deliver health care and other services to homeless people in Seattle. She was once homeless herself, a story she'll tell at a speaking engagement in Ashland this evening, and here now. So to give almost all the credits for Josephine Ensign, family nurse practitioner, master of public health, doctor of public health, professor at the University of Washington School of Nursing in the Department of Psychosocial and Community Health, and the director of the University of Washington's Homelessness Research Initiative's Doorway Project. Josephine Ensign, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you for inviting me.
Start us small. What is the Doorway Project?
The Doorway Project is a state-funded, innovative way of trying to connect young people, teens and young adults, who are experiencing housing insecurity with needed housing. And so that includes our university students, but also the considerable number of homeless teens and young adults we have, especially in the University District of Seattle.
Is this something like a Housing First program?
No. Housing First is a very good model for many subpopulations of homeless people, but not for young people. And so this is more of an innovative model for a navigation center or an engagement center, so that it's much more open to the general public, cafe model, so that it's not stigmatizing to young people who come in, and has just people who are housed in the cafe as well as young people who are not housed.
Is it something like a drop-in center then? I mean, you can use it as, when you mention cafe, that's what it sounds like. You can come or go as you please.
Right. Our official partner is Youth Care, a major homeless youth serving agency in Seattle, and they already have a drop-in center for young people in the university district. So we'll be working in conjunction with them, but it will not be an actual drop-in center. It will be much more of a community cafe, similar to the World Cafe model, which some of your listeners may be already aware of.
Why don't you walk us through that a little bit, too? Yeah, I know World Cafe gets us confused because there's a program on our music channel called World Cafe.
It's probably a very common terminology. So this, the Doorway Project is modeled after the Merge Cafe in Auckland, New Zealand. And so it's a community cafe where anybody can come in for breakfast and lunch. It's a pay it forward model, so that people who can afford the full price or more pay for that. And then people who can't afford it, we have social workers who give them tokens, so that everybody gets access to the exact same food and beverages, and only community tables. And then we have what I call stealth social workers and nurses who are there more kind of in hospitality mode to connect young people, also adults, with needed services that they may need. But a lot of it is also around empathy building, where we have an empathy menu, so that people who come in who may not have experienced or understand homelessness can learn directly about it from what we call experts by experience, so people who have experienced homelessness.
So is there not a lot of empathy in society already for homelessness, do you think, for people who are homeless?
I think there is, but there's also empathy and compassion fatigue. We see that very much right now in Seattle. You probably know there was a big media piece, Is Seattle Dying?, from Como TV documentary, that is definitely about backlash against people who are homeless. And
I hear the same things in Portland, too. It's like, my God, you can't walk the streets anymore. There's tents everywhere.
Right, exactly. So I think that is it's kind of stretching thin for many people who may otherwise have compassion and empathy for people who have less than they do.
One of the things it seems like is that there's a misunderstanding, quite a few, I'm sure, about homelessness. But you mentioned subpopulations, and I think that's probably one of the big ones, is that not all homeless people are created homeless equally. People have very different pathways to get there, and their needs are very different in getting out of homelessness.
Correct. I mean, the term homelessness has been around forever. I mean, going back to Dickens and beyond. But as a kind of a catch-all term, it really started in the 1980s when we had the first really large influx of people, visible homeless people on our streets in the United States. And it really was bringing in, you know, people experiencing mental health issues that had been deinstitutionalized, had been let out of institutions, supposedly into caring communities, but that didn't exist for mental health services in the community. People with addictions, families, especially women who are fleeing domestic violence, intimate partner violence, children, young people who, for whatever reason, are kicked out or who run away from home. So it really became kind of a catch-all. So there are all these subpopulations, which obviously are still with us today, and the aging as well. That's a huge population now.
And, of course, in the bigger cities like Seattle and Portland, one of the issues, too, is high cost of housing. It's getting exorbitant in both of those cities.
Right. I mean, it's hard even for our students or for our children, you know, who become young adults to be able to afford to live actually in Seattle.
Well, that's right, the University of Washington. Yeah, students trying to find housing. That must get interesting, too. Okay, much more to talk about with Josephine Ensign. She wrote a book called Catching Homelessness in 2016. She is in Ashland to give a speech this evening at the Betty Lasore Endowed Lecture of Nursing. That'll be at 7 o'clock at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University, brought in by the Oregon Health and Science University School of Nursing. It is free and open to the public at 7 o'clock tonight. We'll talk more with Josephine Ensign and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Josephine Ensign, who's a professor at the University of Washington School of Nursing, involved with a lot of efforts to help homeless people, primarily through the University of Washington Homeless Research Initiative's Doorway Project, where she is the director. She's a family nurse practitioner, master of public health, doctor of public health, the author of a couple of books, too, including Catching Homelessness in 2016 and Soul Stories, Voices from the Margins, from last year. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange as we visit with Dr. Ensign, who'll be speaking tonight in Ashland at 7. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So let's talk about your own life and catching homelessness. Let's get the chicken and the egg here. Did you dedicate your work to helping homeless people first, or were you homeless yourself first?
I dedicated my work as a nurse to working with homeless and marginalized people before I became homeless. Yes.
So, what was your interest in that kind of medicine in dealing with the vulnerable populations?
Well, I think in retrospect, I mean, obviously, I would probably have a different answer if you'd asked me when I was 20 years old versus now. But I think in retrospect, again, it was because of my own traumas as a young person growing up. But also, I grew up in a very religious family, so there were the religious connections for me then. And I still feel very passionate about using whatever talents I have to work with people who are really marginalized by homelessness and poverty.
So how did you end up homeless yourself?
Complicated, but in a nutshell, my own unexamined and at that point untreated childhood traumas from my family of origin. And that combined with going head-to-head with a very conservative religious ties to Jerry Falwell, place that was running the clinic at that time, and specifically about asking me to ask patients who were dying of HIV/AIDS what they had done, like what their sin was before they died. And that, even though at that point I was considering myself very, very Christian and conservative, that just it did not, I wasn't going to do that. So it was a cascade of effects. Then my marriage fell apart. I was at that point married to a minister and ended up living in my car and in abandoned sheds for about 6 months and doing a lot of couch surfing before I got myself together, and that was actually getting out of Richmond, Virginia, where all of this happened.
In addition to what you were dealing with in your own life, the stories that you tell in Catching Homelessness about the patients you were dealing with, people who were living on the streets, had some severe illnesses, and of course then you mentioned AIDS was part of the disease framework at that time. So there were people who had some great needs, and society not only was indifferent to them, but was actually hostile to them.
That's correct. And then also, and as I talk about in that book, I mean, Richmond, Virginia is the capital of the Confederacy. Really deeply entrenched racism, which we have right here, right? It's not just a Southern problem, but that was another part of it in terms of, again, who was being mostly affected by HIV/AIDS, by homelessness, by then the meth epidemic that was happening as well, and crack cocaine.
I noticed that you write in the book about writing healthcare for the homeless grant application in 1987. I guess I was a little surprised to find that we had such things even that long ago. How long had things like healthcare for the homeless grants existed?
That's a good question. I recently did a history of healthcare for the homeless for the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, and that it started out as a demonstration program from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and that was like in 85, 86, before it became adopted by the federal government as kind of a companion piece to our community health clinics with funding for it. So the one that I wrote was one of the earliest ones for the actual federal healthcare for the homeless, our national program.
We were just talking about AIDS. Obviously, the federal government gets a lot of dings for its slow response to AIDS during the Ronald Reagan presidency. Was the response to homeless as slow, do you think?
Yes. And I think, we talk about homelessness as being a wicked problem, which is not a moral kind of a thing, although it is a moral issue, but more in terms of just how complex it is. So I think that a lot of people were slow to respond to homelessness. Again, kind of going back to deinstitutionalization of people with mental illness, we didn't realize what was happening in terms of not being able to provide the needed services in the community until it was too late.
Josephine Ensign is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She works with the homeless populations in Seattle. She's a family nurse practitioner, doctor of public health, and professor at the University of Washington School of Nursing. So I come back again to the idea of a healthcare for the homeless grant in 1987, and I have to believe that 32 years ago, you thought we might have made more progress than we have made on dealing with not just having homeless people, but the issues they present in terms of things like healthcare.
That's true. I mean, we talk about the institutionalization of homelessness, and I talk about that in the book and also implicate myself, right? Because I basically have made a living off of homelessness, which is a very strange thing to talk about. So of looking at that, I mean, a lot of us back who have kept in touch from that first, 1980s, first really big surge of homelessness, talked about how we thought we were going to be able to at least work our way out of that job, and that that has not happened. And if anything, it's actually worse now.
You wanted to see the end of those jobs, that those kinds of services would no longer be needed? Is that where you were hoping?
Right. I mean, I obviously hoped for a job the rest of my life, but I was hoping to move on to other parts of it. For instance, working with teens and young adults on prevention kinds of efforts.
So, and I think about, I don't know, it sort of bubbled up to me last night, thinking about the fact that here we are talking about your experiences with homeless populations in the 1980s, and the fact is you're dealing, working with teens and young adults now, so we're talking 3-4 generations of homelessness, it sounds like, that you've dealt with.
That's correct. I mean, that's, and again, even though my, probably my, if I had to pick like one subpopulation, of people experiencing housing insecurity and homelessness, it would be teens and young adults. But I am a family nurse practitioner, so I work across the lifespan. So yes, I mean, I've actually had some families who, and we know intergenerational poverty and homelessness is a really big issue. And so I've seen firsthand how that can get, unfortunately, passed on.
So two areas you work with, obviously homeless populations and, of course, from a healthcare perspective. I mean, how closely interrelated are those things? I mean, when we talk about trying to provide healthcare for people who generally can't afford it now, would taking care of some of that address some of the issues with people who end up homeless?
Yes. And that, again, and that's, you know, the second book, the Soul Stories book that I wrote is on trauma-informed care, because we know from the research, from direct experience, the vast majority of people who become homeless, no matter what their age, have significant unaddressed, untreated traumas in their past. And so if we had had better treatment for them earlier on, closer to when the trauma happened, or, you know, better yet, preventing the trauma, especially, significant childhood trauma from happening, we could be preventing a lot of the downstream homelessness.
So, but if the trauma's already happened, then what are some of the, I don't know, triage-y sort of aspects here? What are some of the things you deal with first when you got somebody who has a trauma but also doesn't have a place to live and therefore a comfortable place to deal with the trauma, or at least be comfortable while the trauma is dealt with?
Right. No, that's a really good point, because, I mean, the other part of it is that homelessness itself is a trauma, and then also exposes people to significant traumas, especially if they're out on the streets. So the main thing is, again, within a trauma-informed mindset of providing a safe, stable place to be living while you're working with a person to establish trust around, then if they're open to that, of getting access to appropriate treatment for the trauma.
Josephine Ensign, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, family nurse practitioner, a master of public health, doctor of public health, professor at the University of Washington School of Nursing, and the director of the University of Washington's Doorway Project through the Homelessness Research Initiative. Speaking in Ashland tonight for the Betsy Lasor Endowed Lecture of Nursing from Oregon Health and Science University, the talk titled Walk in My Homeless Shoes, The Promises and Pitfalls of Empathy. That's tonight at 7 at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University. It is free and open to the public, and you can join our conversation right here and right now on the Jefferson Exchange about homelessness, the root causes, and the ways we address it. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I wasn't sure what to expect from the first appendix to your book, Catching Homelessness, Why We Need the Homeless. Mm-hmm. As you point out, sometimes wicked humor can help take the place of an argument, or as functions as an argument. So the fact is that we don't seem to be doing much in getting rid of homelessness. Are we making some fundamental mistakes in how we assess why people are homeless?
I think so. I mean, I think two things that would really improve whatever a region, a city, a county's approach to homelessness is to have much more meaningful coordination of services. Because, I mean, obviously homelessness, in terms of people who are mobile, and so having a regional response to it that's coordinated. And then the other fundamental one that I still see not done enough is having meaningful experts by experience, so people who have experienced homelessness at the table in terms of program and policy making, because they're the ones who really know what that experience is like. I mean, obviously, every person's experience is going to be different, but they have a lot to add to the planning and implementation of policies and programs.
Did the time you spent living in your car and couch surfing give you some insights that you might not have otherwise had? Are they still valuable to you today, I guess, is the question.
Yes, it is. I mean, for one thing, it's humbling. I mean, that's partly why I wrote the book, is how stigmatizing homelessness is. I mean, I felt like I couldn't talk about that professionally, that it would affect my jobs and my family. But it definitely has affected how I provide health care to people who are homeless, as well as informing my research and policy work.
What kinds of things then on just a patient by patient basis? I mean, does that help you do?
I think for one thing, it makes me realize that whatever kind of medical nursing bag of tools that I have in terms of talking with patients, screening them for cholesterol or blood pressure, the things that you or I might have when we go to see our primary care provider, that I still do that, but I do that secondary to establishing trust and realizing that people have had years and years of trauma and probably not good experiences with people in authority, including healthcare personnel. So I am much more likely to just sit down with a new patient and say, you know, what's going on with you, talk with them. A lot of times young people will be writing in a journal or drawing and ask them about that. I mean, that's a way into learning about them as a person, but also establishing trust. And obviously needing to have a place where the time for that can be factored in. We can't do that in 5-10 minute appointments.
You have anticipated my next question then, because we have talked over and over again about the medical profession and the need to move on from patient to patient, and how patients feel shortchanged with the time. They don't feel like they've really gotten the attention of the provider, and the providers don't feel like they're having enough time to establish with the patient. So you must have things structured differently then to be able to spend as much time as you need to get to know somebody before you start doing things like slapping on the blood pressure cuff and taking pulses.
Correct. And that's our healthcare for the homeless programs. They recognize that is a significant part of it is establishing trust. And so even in healthcare for the homeless clinics, you still have to be able to see as many people as are coming in, whether it's drop-in or scheduled, mostly drop-in. But it still is prioritizing that, having more time, having more people to be able to talk, like, and follow up in terms of health education with people experiencing homelessness.
We talked about the trauma, how difficult it is to deal with the trauma that leads to homelessness, that homelessness itself provides. That's a mental, emotional situation. Now, with physical health, I can't imagine it's any benefit to getting somebody well again when they're not feeling well to spend as much time as they do outdoors or not knowing where they're going to be staying that night, that sort of thing.
Right. I mean, the other part of it when we talk about trauma is the exposure to violence on the streets. You know, the public is generally, we're afraid of homeless people, and we know from the research that people who are homeless are much more likely to be victims of violence than they are to be perpetrators of violence. So yes, I mean, we talk about housing itself is healthcare. And so having medical respite programs for people who are homeless, we have some really excellent models for that in Seattle, and they're catching on throughout the country as well. Of having a safe, stable place for somebody to recuperate, whether it's after an operation or just from something like pneumonia exposure on the streets.
That used to be the role of hospitals, didn't it?
Yes, it did. But not anymore.
Hospitals not meant to keep people for long. Only the very sickest.
No,
people stay
and in many cases, probably for a good reason, right? I mean, hospitals can also. It's not a great environment for healing.
You mentioned a moment ago that a lot of people are afraid of homeless people, and that homeless people are more often victims of violence, not the perpetrators of it. How would you recommend that people think about homeless people? What sorts of approaches, or what sort of, not avoidances anyway, would you advocate for people to put their own fears to rest, or just not encourage them?
Well, I think for one thing, of becoming more educated about that. I mean, I was reading the Ashland news, one of the newspapers, mm-hmm. and there was a gentleman who went out randomly and stabbed somebody in Medford.
Right. Mm-hmm. And
who also stabbed somebody who was homeless, although they haven't found that person. You know, realizing the news sources and how that's relayed. I mean, he did have a place to stay.
He was not homeless, right?
Right.
Came outside of his apartment on Crater Lake Avenue. I remember reading the piece myself, looking for the first person he saw to stab because he was angry.
He said that his schizophrenia was out of control. So I think of becoming educated, figuring out what's within your reach for being able to do. I mean, one of the very basic things that I tell people is to not ignore somebody on the street. You don't have to, like, if they're begging for something, you don't have to give them anything if you don't want to.
But even saying no, sorry, acknowledges
exactly.
Them.
Just mm-hmm. you know, as much as you can, look them in the eye, say, and acknowledge them as a person. Because the worst thing is to ignore somebody, because then it's like you're invisible. You're not a person.
Josephine Ensign, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Catching Homelessness and Soul Stories, Voices from the Margins, back on the Jefferson Exchange with Joe Ensign and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about homelessness with somebody who not only works with populations of homeless people, but experienced homelessness herself. Josephine Ensign is a family nurse practitioner and a professor at the University of Washington School of Nursing, where she runs the Doorway Project for the UW's Homeless Research Initiative. She has written a couple of books, including Catching Homelessness in 2016 and Soul Stories, Voices from the Margins in 2018. She'll be speaking tonight at 7 at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University, a lecture from the Oregon Health and Science University School of Nursing based on the SOU campus. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Becca in Lane County who says, I heard about a huge tent city in Southern California that stretches for miles. Might this not be a community that supports members so they don't feel so isolated? Lots of problems, I'm sure, but better than nothing?
So thank you, Becca. That is a very good question. And that's something that I talk about is that homelessness is, as oftentimes we say, just throw housing at it. Housing is the solution, and it's not the only solution. I mean, it really is about these connections and about home that we all have. And so we do know that people who live, for instance, in tent encampments, whether they're sanctioned or unsanctioned, like the one in Southern California you're talking about, oftentimes you build community within those, and that can be supported with appropriate health care and also obviously hygiene and safety sorts of things. Whether that's a long-term solution, a lot of people don't want to live in a tent or a tiny house the rest of their lives. So then having case managers that help them to figure out where it is that they want to move along to.
You just said that throwing housing at the situation is not the only answer. I know Seattle is one of the places where a housing first model was at least attempted by some organizations. And has it appeared to have done anything in terms of reducing the homeless population?
It's controversial, right? I mean, we're waiting to get the results of our latest point-in-time count from January that I participated in the University District. And so Housing First, I mean, it is interesting because Seattle is, we've had models, like, for instance, the 1811 building, which was a wet house, one of the first places where chronic inebriates could go and continue to drink.
So not a dry out tank, but a place to
right,
keep, you know,
right.
You...
So really the harm reduction model, but to be in a place so that they're indoors, where there are nurses and other people, case managers that can help them. And it has definitely reduced, it's been cost effective in terms of reducing the number of times they have to go to emergency rooms or, you know, be picked up on the streets, taken to the jail, et cetera. And it also can, in many cases, help people have longer, healthier lives. So, yes, I mean, Seattle has a longstanding housing first model, and especially for families, that makes a lot of sense. Of getting them, you know, not having them go through emergency shelters, but really try to have, again, this coordinated approach where you get them as quickly as possible into permanent housing. But obviously, we don't have enough permanent, subsidized, safe, affordable housing. The other thing that we see a lot in the Seattle-King County area is that if those do exist, they're in outlying areas that then
because
a person,
the housing is cheaper.
But, right. Mm-hmm. And then the person or the family then has to take like 3 or 4 buses to get back to the healthcare providers or the case managers that they had established trust with, or to get to jobs. So that makes it a lot more difficult.
Is one of the keys, you think, to reducing homelessness addressing healthcare better? I mean, having more healthcare available for more people and more people available to deliver that healthcare? I mean, we talk about the issues, the example on purely physical health alone, the example of people with diabetes who don't keep up on the medication, end up in the emergency room a lot, use up a lot of healthcare facilities and dollars if somebody had been with them to help them know to take their medicine on time, things might have been different. So, I mean, when we get to a model where there are a few people ending up with things that make them homeless, is healthcare, do you think, a major component of that?
I think it's an important component, and that's not just because I'm a nurse and a nurse practitioner and part of that, and would like to think that we're important. It is important. I think that... especially if there's better access to comprehensive health care. So that includes not just the diabetes care, but also behavioral health, mental health treatment, access to dental care, all of the different kinds of health care that is really needed, that can be a huge part of helping prevent people from becoming homeless as well as helping them exit homelessness more quickly.
There's a blog post that you put up over the weekend called "They Must Move," which indicated the length of time we've been dealing with homeless populations, and the illustration that shows up there. I do recommend people getting a look at that. Is a woman who appears to be pointing at a shanty town outside of her home, because that's what they were called back then, not homeless encampments, but shanty towns. Mm-hmm. So obviously we had them a long time ago, and it seems like that's been the general societal urge, is like, well, get that out of here without any regard for what that is that you're getting out of and where those people are going to.
Correct, yeah. And that photograph is probably from the Seattle Times, and it's a montage from the 30s, so it's... supposedly a housewife from Beacon Hill looking down at Hooverville, which is in downtown Seattle, and that really did exist, many Hoovervilles in the Seattle area as well as nationwide. So, I mean, obviously that's been going on since the dawn of time, is NIMBYism and how to take care of people who are less fortunate than ourselves, but not wanting that kind of visible poverty and suffering to be right in our backyard. So it's how as a society, as people interested in kind of a civil society, how do we deal with taking care of people?
And there's an even broader perspective that you bring up in your book, Catching Homelessness, because you point out, as is made clear to you in understanding the history of Virginia, that this is a place where populations of people have bumped other people out. sent them on the road. And this makes us think about, you know, if you let yourself consider all the ramifications here, you can think of homelessness in terms that you also think of things like refugees, economic refugees, war refugees, people who are just moving from place to place because things aren't good. Mm-hmm. And the constant resentment of the people who are in the place in the first place, and the fact that sometimes there is a shoving out of the existing population or the pre-existing population.
Right. And that's, I mean, the book that I'm working on right now, which is the history of health and homelessness in King County. I mean, looking at even our poor laws in our country, I mean, we adopted those from the British poor laws. And so that was, you know, the vagrancy laws, the pauper laws of having, first of all, the families were supposed to take care of them. And if they couldn't, the parish or the county. And they were warned out and sent back to their county of origin, that it was their responsibility to take care of people. So that
there's an echo now, and like, here's a bus ticket, go home.
Right. And our country was built on, and there's a British historian who I love who has come up with the term welfare colonialism, of shipping people, the unwanted, out to other places. I mean, that's a lot of how our country was formed and what we still do in our country.
So in terms of trying to provide services for people who live on the streets now, I mean, what kind of costs do you pay in trying to do this and trying to keep empathy alive, mm-hmm. Keep compassion alive, deal with the concerns of your patients and not get overwhelmed by it?
It's a good question. I was down in San Francisco last week and went across the Golden Gate Bridge for the first time in my life. I was driven over there to see a medical respite program in Marin County, of all places, very, very rich county. And the Golden Gate Bridge is beautiful, but the first thing and like what I was completely focused on was, from my perspective, public health, nursing, why there weren't more barriers to people committing suicide of killing themselves, jumping off the bridge.
And there have been many over the years, yes.
Right. And realizing, like thinking about that of, wait a minute, what's going on for me? Am I too close to all of this that I can't appreciate the absolute beauty of Golden Gate Bridge, and I'm thinking of suicide. So it's constantly reminding myself when those things come up. I mean, I journal. I do, you know, a lot of reflective practice myself, have a really supportive family. So I know when I'm starting to get crispy, mm-hmm. around the edges, and I'm needing to pull back and do things like, you know, be with my granddaughter, or, you know, be with puppies and kittens and, you know, butterflies. But I'm not staying in that space, right? Because I'm still wanting to do this work.
Does committing the work to paper, in a sense, get it out of your head? I mean, you get to put it in a resting place that doesn't necessarily reside between your ears?
It does, but it's also, for me, a way of kind of working out what really is going on, because it was through journaling about this. I mean, I was given a lovely paperweight of the Golden Gate Bridge. I had to give it away because it was just reminding me again, and it was through writing my journal. I was like, oh, well, wait a minute. This is, a sign symptom of getting too close to at least the topic of suicide within homelessness.
How big an issue is that?
That's huge. I mean, that just in terms, like, again, going back to trauma, that is a very large risk factor in terms of suicide. The very first homeless pauper of Seattle, back in the early days of it. I mean, there, you know, recurring suicides, not just now, but in the past as well. So that is a very big risk.
So we obviously have a lot to learn as individuals and a lot to learn as a society too. And you've given us some ideas thus far about, you know, not to ignore people on the street, for example. But this goes on and on. We don't seem to really make any new progress. Do you feel like progress is being made in dealing with homelessness, or at least the issues that people have while they're homeless?
Yes. I mean, we do know that, especially during the Obama administration, with dealing with kind of the Great Recession, of having people come together to try and kind of stave off super increases in homelessness because of the housing market crumbling. And then, especially during that time, programs were put into place in terms of veteran homelessness, because that's very overrepresented in terms of homelessness. And we have seen nationwide at least a reduction in homelessness among our veterans. I mean, it still is way too big a problem. Again, having that, I mean, you also, from a healthcare perspective, you have to wonder, because the VA is our closest to socialized medicine. I mean, there are problems with it, but at least they do have access to good healthcare. So I think that was part of what helped with the reduction of homelessness among our veterans.
We have a long email here that is just too long to read in here, but I do see some issues in here. I think I would start with addressing early child care development and education and early recognition of mental health needs. I mean, are these good moves as suggested by our guest?
Yes, I think the earlier we can start. I mean, even going back and supporting women when they're pregnant, or even before they become pregnant, because we know that a lot of the kind of epigenetics, the level of stress, even in utero for the child, for a woman who's dealing with different kinds of issues, including intimate partner violence and homelessness. So yes, of having much more emphasis on early prevention of these issues. Head Start, we know, is an excellent payoff in terms of the cost-benefit programs. For instance, national programs like the Nurse Family Partnership, which is excellent, and again, evidence-based in terms of where we could really be putting our money.
All right, a lot of deflection early to avoid having to make big changes late. Josephine Ensign is a professor at the University of Washington School of Nursing, the director of the Doorway Project at UW's Homeless Research Initiative, family nurse practitioner, doctor of public health. And speaking tonight in Ashland, Walk in My Homeless Shoes, The Promises and Pitfalls of Empathy. That's the Oregon Health and Science University School of Nursing Endowed Lecture of Nursing, Betsy Lasore Endowed Lecture, 7 o'clock tonight, Rogue River Room, Stevenson Union, Southern Oregon University Campus. Josephine Ensign, thanks for visiting.
Thanks for having me.